Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. It is Sunday, January 20th, 2008. President Bush gave Israel the green light to do whatever it pleases in Gaza, and on Friday Israel sealed all border crossings into Gaza, blocked humanitarian aid, and launched a massive air attack which destroyed the abandoned former Interior Ministry building in Gaza City, sending a tide of shrapnel crashing against adjacent apartment buildings, killing one 47-year-old woman and wounding 50 other people, 30 of whom were attending a wedding party, including children. United Nations Special Rapporteur John Dugard declared that those responsible for such cowardly action are guilty of serious war crimes and should be prosecuted and punished for their crimes. Israel killed 40 Palestinian civilians in the past week alone and injured at least 80 others. Hamas declared that it has launched some rockets for the first time since taking power in Gaza in June 2007. A convoy is scheduled to enter Gaza next Saturday, January 26th, as part of the International Day of Activism. The convoy will bring truckloads of desperately needed water filters to be distributed by the End the Siege campaign in Gaza. The Israeli organizations involved in the convoy include Gush Shalom, Coalition for Women for Peace, Combatants for Peace, Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, New Profile, Hadash, Balad, Adala, Tarabut, Hitabrut, Alternative Information Center, Bat Shalom, Anarchists Against the Wall, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, the Follow-Up Committee of the Arab Population in Israel, and Psychoactive. The convoy will also bring many Israeli citizens and Israeli media. Also, next Saturday, January 26th, a demonstration will be held in Harvard Square from 12 noon to 2 p.m. to protest against the willful starvation of Palestinian children and the wanton slaughter of Gaza's civilian population. That slaughter, which has been approved by the President of the United States, has to stop. One must wonder if there is any end to the visions of death and destruction this butcher president of ours has when he speaks to God. Today we have the distinct privilege of spending the rest of our time on the air with our distinguished guest, Dr. Joel Covell, Distinguished Professor of Social Studies at Bard College. Professor Covell needs no introduction. Any attempt on my part to describe his distinguished career in medicine, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, religious philosophy, political science, communication, eco-socialism, political activism, and numerous publications, and his many accomplishments in these fields would leave us no time for the program. So I will confine myself to the subject at hand, Zionism. Professor Covell is a prolific writer who has published 10 books and over 100 articles. His most recent book, Overcoming Zionism, published by the Pluto Press in the United Kingdom and distributed by the University of Michigan Press, predictably earned him the ire of what Rabbi Arthur Waskow of the Shalom Center in Philadelphia called Jewish officialdom, or the official Jewish institutional structures, including the Michigan chapters of the American Jewish Congress, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and B'nai B'rith. As a result, the University of Michigan Press temporarily suspended distribution of the book in August of 2007 amid the now tiresome, shrill accusations of anti-Semitism. Once again, it appeared that the age-old tactic of killing the messenger to deny access to the message had succeeded. In October of 2007, however, following a growing campaign led by fellow academics and civil libertarians, principally historian Howard Zinn, the University of Michigan reversed its decision. To learn more about Dr. Covell and his book Overcoming Zionism, please visit his website at joelcovell.org. Dr. Covell will be giving a talk on his book this coming Tuesday, January 22nd, at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, starting at 7 p.m. The talk will be followed by book signing and community discussion and a dinner at 9 p.m. at the Fugaku restaurant at 1280 Beacon Street. He joins us now by telephone. Welcome to This Week in Palestine, Dr. Covell.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Your book, Overcoming Zionism, clearly debunks the deeply held myths commonly associated with Zionism. Judging from the furor it has aroused, you must have done something right.
That's the way I felt about it. It's an odd way of being phrased, but I'll take it. It means, I hit a nerve, and I really was writing with that intention in mind. You know, it deserves to be pointed out that the other side of it is what they call, I don't know if you remember, Senator Moynihan used to call benign neglect of the racial problem. Well, this is malign neglect. I mean, a book of this sort is going to simply be neglected by every quote-unquote responsible media outlet in the United States, including a lot of those on the left. So you have to wait for an incident of this sort in order to get your name known, and that's basically what happened.
Would it be fair to say that the furor, at least, is due in part to the fact that you have revealed the dark side of Zionism, as well as some dark chapters in Jewish religious teachings, which many would prefer remain in the attic?
Oh, most definitely. But also that I do so not, just to denounce, but to clear the way for a hopeful resolution. And I think that the people involved with the Zionist apparatus in all of its forms have a great stake in not allowing anything hopeful or positive to come out. They must be constantly seen and understand themselves as being endlessly persecuted and surrounded by anti-Semitism and anything that people say that casts aspersions on them is due to this immemorial hatred of Jews and not to anything they've done and so on. So yes. If a book like mine postulates that we can resolve this, although in order to resolve it we have to overcome Zionism, that's going to be anathema. That's the red flag to the bull.
Let me cite as background the dictionary definitions of Zion and Zionism. Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary tells us that Zion is, quote, the Jewish homeland that is symbolic of Judaism or of Jewish national aspiration, the ideal nation or society envisaged by Judaism, heaven, utopia. And Zionism is defined as, quote, an international movement originally for the establishment of a Jewish national or religious community in Palestine, and later for the support of modern Israel. And it's worth noting here, parenthetically, the astonishing dictionary use of the word Zionism as meaning support for modern Israel. Does that definition in any way resemble Zionism as it has been practiced from the early 19th century until today?
Well, in some way, but it's, of course, a highly selective rendering of it. There are many variants of Zionism, and the one that is relevant here is the one we call political Zionism, where we're not just talking about a Jewish community in historic Palestine, but a Jewish state in historic Palestine. And there's a very big difference. Jews were able to come over and build communities, usually of religious sorts, without any problem at all throughout the Ottoman Empire and even before. And so any meaning of Zionism that was simply a community that would worship and be themselves was met with no particular resistance. But once the idea was hatched to create a nation state, which involves forceful control over a territory, which involves, systematic violence, and in this case, the necessity of simply expelling the indigenous people, then the whole thing took on a very different meaning.
Yeah, well, I mean, Zionism as a plea for the establishment of a safe haven where Jews can be safe from the persecutions takes on the mantle of moral a moral imperative, whereas the Zionism that has been practiced by the Zionist leaders before the creation of the state and ever since the creation of the state, the kind of Zionism that calls for the deconstruction, dissolution, and annihilation of nations,
right,
is a criminal enterprise.
Yes, and that's not a very good way to be safe. I mean, if you want a safe haven, it's a pretty good idea not to commit massive and systematic crimes to obtain it, because you're never going to be safe under those circumstances.
Well, isn't it a little bit like Jekyll and Hyde, two sides of the same coin? One whips up the idealized Jekyll image when pressed, and attacks those who would talk about Mr. Hyde and tarnish the ideal image.
Well, that's true, but I would even see it a little more psychodynamically than that. As you mentioned, I was trained as a psychoanalyst, which is that I was trained to understand the human mind as a tissue of contradictions with very varying, you know, forms and outcomes. But in this case, you have a massive contradiction that I call the bad conscience of Zionism, in that the identity of the Jews is yes, the Jekyll identity, but it's not that is put away and then the Hyde identity takes over. It's that the Jekyll identity persists in the unconscious. That is to say, Jews, and here the audience should realize that I myself was raised in a rather conventional Jewish family in Brooklyn, New York, and went through all the rituals of that, are trained from early age to see themselves as the eternal victims, to see themselves as eternally innocent, put upon by the harsh outer world, and on the other hand, as the bearers of the high ethical principles that allegedly arise from the Old Testament. Old Testament is a lot more complex than that, as I'm sure you know. But in any event, those high ethical principles are associated with being persecuted, are, you know, a necessary part of the identity of being Jewish, and that's, as you say, the Jekyll identity. The Hyde identity is superimposed on that because of the necessity of obtaining a nation state, which involves force and systematic expulsion of those who stand in the way, namely the indigenous Palestinian people. So here you have a contradiction of the most fundamental sort, where your identity is Jekyll, but your actions are Hyde. So it's not that you have Jekyll one day and Hyde the other. It's that the Jekyll identity persists under the surface when the Hyde identity takes over and people have to face up to the necessity of forcibly seizing this land, that is to say, robbing the indigenous inhabitants. And so you have this built-in, nightmarish contradiction in the being of the Zionists. And that contradiction has played out in many different ways, and there's no way to really understand modern Israel and Zionism without seeing the way it's played out. And one of those ways is to be very, very hypersensitive to criticism, which is exactly what we see. You know, that's why I got slammed by the Jewish Zionist community in Michigan and elsewhere, because I call attention to that contradiction, to the fact that the good Jew is not the only kind of Jew we have. We have to also take into account the Jew that is seizing the land of the Palestinians, and when you call attention to that, you break that tenuous bond between the Jekyll and the Hyde side of things, and you catch it. You catch hell for it, which is, of course, what happens. But also one of the main features of that complex is that it leads to radical devaluation of the indigenous peoples. I mean, this is the source, in psychological terms, of the racism which infests Israel, and which is the most, most grossest aspect of Israeli life and being. As if you think of yourself as the eternal victim, and you're involved in conquering and expelling an indigenous people, well, the only way to deal with that is to say those indigenous peoples are attacking you, and you're their victim, and which of course is what happens. This is where the mystique of the Palestinian terrorist arises, or the Palestinian barbarian, and so on and so forth. And in fact, and this also has to do with the the way in which Israel consistently provokes violence. I mean, there's nothing more consistent over the history of Israel the way than after every quote-unquote peace initiative, they start attacking. The best way to...
Or perhaps they start attacking because it is a threat to Israel's ambitions for empire to have a peace initiative where Israel has to give back the land that it has robbed.
Exactly, but
it has to derail every peace effort.
It's also a threat to their identity as being the victim. You know, they need to see themselves as victimized, and so they go ahead and they attack. Here's a quote from Golda Meir, who's a treasure trove of Zionist grotesquery. She said once, I forget the exact year, she said, we Israelis will never forgive the Arabs for making us kill them. In other words, when you attack them...
It's a remarkable sophistry.
Yeah, even then you're being the victim. They're making you feel bad about it, and therefore you have to attack them harder. I mean, this is the kind of crazy psychology that inhabits that Zionist mind.
And much effort in the vein of psychology, there's much effort was made over the years, or one might say successfully, to fuse together as an indissoluble whole in the minds of Jews everywhere the notions of Jewishness, Zionism, and Israel. So any criticism of Israel or of Israel's egregious actions on the ground is immediately taken to be an expression of anti-Semitism. You've revealed the fallacy of that connection in your book. You write about the cloak of socialism with which Zionism draped itself to persuade Jews that in the Zionist project they would be breaking with their narrow tribal past and move into the bright light of universalism, thereby redeeming the expanded meaning of covenant. What did you mean by the expanded meaning of covenant?
Well, expanded in the sense that the covenant between God and Abraham became expanded into the entire sense of mission of the Jewish people for greatness and for entitlement to larger portions of the earth, shall we say. The covenant can be read either as a claim that you should be morally correct and ethically upright, but also as a claim that you should be great and that you shall, you know, conquer the earth, which is not this, you see, to be sure, the way to be morally upright. And so as the covenant expands, it draws into itself these kinds of contradictory meanings and eventually becomes Israeli imperialism. And you know, and again, you have these weird phenomena which students of the State of Israel are familiar with, namely that the country has never declared its national boundaries. Because if it declared its national boundaries, it wouldn't have room for the expansion of the covenant, so to speak.
Right,
so
but the covenant was also it was not unconditional. The covenant was made the express condition that Jews follow the teachings of the Lord,
exactly,
as embodied in the Torah. So it is not unconditional, even though it is read to be unconditional.
That's right. That's the expanded version. It's unconditional.
Right. And therefore, you know, when the Torah says that they, as long as they are holy, what they did recently in the last 10 years was to pervert that that condition, that they keep themselves holy, into keeping the land holy, in other words, free from non-Jews.
Right. Why do you say the last 10 years?
Well, let's say the last 10 years was perhaps the most the most savage.
Oh, okay.
Right. But there's also something that I need to mention, which is the imperial ambitions of Israel. And here... let me see. The incarnation of that imperial ambition was probably best described in an essay which Israeli journalist Oded Yinon, who was once attached to Israel's foreign ministry, wrote in Hebrew in the Journal for Judaism and Zionism in February of 1982. It was entitled A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. Mm. The authenticity of this essay was attested to by Israel Shahak, who also translated it and edited it. The strategy or plan was described as operating on two essential premises. To survive, Israel must become an important regional power, and secondly, Israel must divide the Middle East into small entities by means of the deconstruction and dissolution of all Arab states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say, then, that Zionism, and by extension Israel, have tied their existence to the non-existence of Israel's neighboring nations?
Yes. Well, that's part, you know, it's an inherently... By the way, before I go on, would you give me and our listeners another reading of the name of the person who wrote that?
The name of the person who wrote that is Oded Yinon, O-D-E-D Yinon, Y-I-N-O-N.
Thank you.
And was edited by Israel Shahak.
Right, so thank you. Well, that's a remarkable document, but by no means unique in the history of Zionism, because it's really inherent to the history of Zionism, as I point out in several points in my book. I didn't know that essay, but I'm going to look it up myself. But it's consistent. It brings out into the open certain tendencies which are absolutely essential to be understood. The imperial ambitions of Zionism are partly a product of the covenant mentality, but also a product of very harsh, material exigencies. The fact of the matter is that the Zionist settlers and the Zionist project was extremely weak at the beginning, and in order to obtain its ends, its leadership, beginning with Theodor Herzl, realized that they couldn't do so alone. They could only do so by becoming the instrument of a larger imperial power. And that's, you have to keep that in mind. Without such instrumentality, the whole thing would never have happened, as I'm sure you know. When I speak about this, I often read these lines from Herzl, which were written in 1895 in his diaries, and he says here, "We must expropriate gently the private property on the state assigned to us." And that's even before the International Zionist Movement was launched. That's a basic principle of it. You have to expropriate, which means get rid of the inhabitants and take over the land, rob them. You have to do it gently, which means you must use deception. And also, you have to become the client of a powerful state, which they eventually did with England and now with the United States. So you have the imperial ambition being fed both by these underground streams of covenant mentality and the grandiosity of that, part of the Zionist identity, but also by the necessity to ride piggyback on a larger power. And you see that played out, of course, in the United States, but also played out in the... this is such a complicated subject, isn't it? Because, one of the major issues that's happening today is that Zionism is now becoming under criticism from certain elements of the U.S. Ruling class, in part, because of the tremendous role played in fomenting the Iraq War, to some extent by Israel, but to even greater extent, of course, by neoconservatives within the U.S. Ruling apparatus. And these neoconservatives are ultra-Zionist, and the entirety of the Bush 2 administration has been deeply colored by them, and colored by there's a sort of a convergence now between the traditional and deeply embedded Zionist impulse to expand without end and the Bush aggressive preemptive doctrine, which is also to expand without end. So this is where you get this kind of alliance between these two powers, which sometimes almost seem like, one. Although it's not really the case, however, it's certainly a deep, for practical purpose, it seems that way.
Israel and the United States are forming an axis of conquest of the Middle East.
No question. And that notion of dividing, and to get back to Yinon's a very important enunciation of it, that involves not just getting rid of the indigenous Palestinians, but also, as he says, and as events have proven, to actually destabilize the entire region. And they cannot tolerate the presence of any integral power amongst the Arab nations that is going to stand up to them. And this is, of course, Saddam Hussein was clearly in no sense a good person, in my view. Nonetheless, refused to knuckle under and was exactly such a power, and they stopped at nothing to try to help their giant patron, the United States, in their goal of annihilating Iraq. And that is a very important component to the Iraq War. And of course, as people do realize, it is a incipient or a potential component to a war with Iran, which is the other and greater power that will not, you know, knuckle under to the Zionist challenges. So you have the, you know, not just this small little movement that started amongst some Jewish intellectuals in Central and Eastern Europe over a century ago, has now become sort of embedded in the most destabilizing and frightening elements of Western imperialism.
It's a liquidization of the American government.
Yes.
This brings to mind Rabbi Fishman's presentation at the 1947 United Nations Committee of Inquiry, where he said that the promised land lies between the Euphrates and the Nile.
Yes.
But the map that he displayed was taken out of Herzl's diary.
Mm-hmm.
And that map showed all of Jordan, all of Palestine, all of Jordan, all of Syria, all of Lebanon,
right,
large swaths of Iraq, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia,
right,
as part of the promised land. Well,
and Ariel Sharon more or less said the same thing.
Yeah, well, given the fact that these plans are not unknown to the Arab countries, is it not plausible to assume that these same Arab countries, although they may be weak now, will someday be forced into waging a war for their survival?
That's quite plausible.
And does it not follow then that Israel's Zionist leadership poses the greatest threat to Jews everywhere?
I quite agree. I mean, that's among the many layers of irony, this is certainly a very important one. You know, the notion that Israel would be a safe haven for the Jews and a zone of safety is absolutely ridiculous, and it's going to be proved, and it has been proven, but it's going to get more so, just the opposite. There's no conceivable resting point or equilibrium point within this entity, and people have to realize that. And the implication of your remark, Sharif, is so important, and it deserves to be underscored, because when we're talking about making basic changes within Israel, when I'm talking about it, and I hear you say the same, we're talking about changes that are essential for the Jewish people as well as the other peoples of the world and of the region. I mean, this is in the deep interest of Jews everywhere to be done with this sad and bitter chapter in their history signified by the rise of Israel and Zionism.
But there is also another reason why Israel Zionist leaders and the Jewish officialdom in the diaspora, which operates under their instructions, pose the greatest threat to Jews. And that is the continuous fanning of the fires of existential fear to keep open the wounds of the past, and then clawing into these open wounds when blind support is demanded for Israel's imperial ambitions. It is as if the Zionists...
You write that?
Yes. It is as if the Zionists were telling their people, I won't let you heal from the wounds of the past. I want you to suffer so I can get from you the blind support I want to pursue my ambitions.
Very well said.
So the Jews, all the Jews in the world, are being kept hostage to Israel's ambitions.
Right.
Is that not a crime? And should Jews not hold their Zionist leaders to account and even try them for crimes committed against Jews?
Well, that would be a great day it's some ways off, but I think it's a worthy goal. Definition of anti-Semitism, which is bandied about so loosely in these matters, can only make sense if it's what you would call an essentialization of the Jews. If it's something that places the Jew into a historically, you know, predefined and rigid position, namely, the Jews are moneylenders, the Jews are conspirators. You know, these are the anti-Semitic statements that have haunted Jews throughout history. It's very real. I mean, and there's no question about that. On the other hand, Zionism, although it's supposed to be protecting Jews against this persecution, is, in my view, also a form of anti-Semitism because it essentializes Jews. It says the only way to truly be a Jew, you're not a real Jew unless you believe in Israel, unless you believe that your destiny is the state of Israel. And that's an essentialist statement, you know, saying Jews are this way or must be this way, and if they're not, they're not real Jews.
And as you pointed out in your book, the Webster Dictionary's 1956 edition adds two other items to this. It says that anti-Semitism is opposition to Zionism and sympathy with the opponents of the State of Israel.
Yes,
in other
right.
words, the dictionary would have us believe that a person or organization is anti-Semitic if it is opposed to Zionism or has any sympathy with the plight of Palestinians.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? That's 1956.
1956.
How long ago this is, over 50 years, and it still persists. I know that Arab and Palestinian Muslim groups have tried vigorously to overturn that, but they don't have the clout to do so. You know,
if you go back to the debate over Zionism is racism, you find Sayers' defense of that proposition was extremely eloquent,
mm-hmm.
whereas Senator Moynihan's was was terribly weak,
mm-hmm.
and just. Sanguine but weak.
Yeah, I think we should just pause a moment and review that. This particular notion that Zionism is racism is really at the political fulcrum here. I think that if that notion is made unthinkable, then the Zionist project can sail on. Whereas on the other hand, if that notion becomes recognized as truth, then Zionism is in the deepest trouble. And it was passed as such in the 70s, and it was eventually overturned thanks to the United States and John Bolton in the early 90s. And then you had the Durban Conference of 2001, and now there's which the United States and Israel basically wrecked because of the threat posed to Zionism by that notion that it's racism. But you know, there's another Durban conference coming up in 2009.
Yeah, but
I think people have to look into that and see that it's done right.
Well, it's again the game of Jekyll and Hyde. Zionism is always portrayed in public as a call for a safe haven. Whereas the other side of the coin, the Hyde coin, is the one that no one wants to talk about.
Yeah.
And so we always have this campaign of hiding the truth and silencing its voices. Let me invite you for a minute to think of Israel as an idea, an idealized idea, a utopia, if you will, that rank-and-file Jews imagined in their minds, which was not in the Zionist leaders' minds, but in the rank-and-file Jews imagined it when Israel was in the process of being created. That Israel today is a far cry from its original model is immaterial. The idealized idea persists. And any attempt to show the reality of Israel today is vigorously attacked as an attempt to sully its image and therefore indicative of anti-Semitism and so on and so on and so on. And we have the Jekyll and Hyde game all over again. Show the good side and hide the bad one and silence anyone who would give voice to that dark side. What do you think would be a way of reaching that idea? which is so deeply ingrained.
Well, it is deeply ingrained, but I don't think that any idea as such is immutable, and all ideas are subject to development and correction. I mean, the you know, the notion of the divine right of kings is once considered, you know, ingrained and given, and you know, in the heavens. So this notion, which you correctly point out, it's very well said what you just said, should not be thought of as unalterable, in my view. And I think that we're actually seeing a change. And I think that people should recognize that not just humanity everywhere, but even within the Jewish community, you're seeing a change. And very interesting sociological study done last year, American Jews, which asked Jews of different ages, a wide sample, would they, quote, regard the disappearance of the state Israel, of state of Israel, as an existential blow, which is another way of saying what you just said. You know what I mean? An ideal that is so deeply embedded within your being that your existence depends upon it. Existential. So the very interesting finding there was that the older the Jewish respondent was, the more he or she felt that such a change would be an existential blow. That is to say, for Jewish people over 60, say, a considerable majority, like three-quarters, two-thirds, so,
they want to maintain that image.
They want to maintain that image, but that's for the ones over 60. If you get to Jewish people under 35, okay, less than half, only 40% or so, said that they would regard the change, you know, the basic transformation of Israel into a non-Zionist state would be existentially grievous to them. That's very important. That shows that there are changes afoot in the Jewish community itself, and I think that those changes are extraordinarily hopeful. And I also think that that tells us that there's no magic here, and there's no button to push, you know, but that there's something to be said for persistent and, you know, and patient and thoughtful and work that respects, you know, the other person, that you gradually work away at this because you know you're doing what is right. You know you're doing what is truthful and right, and you know that somewhere you're being heard. And I think that this is the case. I think the reason that the Zionist lobbies are all the more wild in their denunciation in books like mine is because at some level they know they're fighting a losing battle, and that they're being backed into a corner, and they're more and more desperate on that account, so they're very dangerous. I'm not disputing that at all, but the times are moving against them.
Let me turn, if I may, to your view of the two-state solution.
Sure.
You say very eloquently in your book, and I quote, "Thus, if the basic condition for a two-state solution is that there be two functional states on the ground, the two-state solution has been annihilated. 58 years of aggression and chewing away on the part of Zionism has simply eliminated this as a real possibility and reduced it to a script for the posturings of statesmen, the filling of airtime on the networks and column inches in the press, and the diverting of the mind from coming to grips with what needs to be done in Israel-Palestine. It remains only as a false hope and another source of propaganda, allowing Israel to be perceived as a bona fides member of the community of nations." End of quote. I've never seen a clearer analysis of the morbidity of the two-state solution.
Thank you. I worked at that.
But what I would like to ask is this, in the few minutes remaining to me, because we are, I think, running out of time pretty soon, in about 2 or 3 minutes. What thoughts do you have on how one can found a single democratic state with equal rights for all its citizens, particularly given the fact that the logic of Zionism, as you also state in your book, is rooted in the most archaic and vengeance-ridden strata of Judaic being?
That's right. Well, I think one way is to consistently point out this truth, namely that the two-state solution has been rendered meaningless, and that I think the Prime Minister of Israel said something very interesting after the Annapolis meeting, which was, of course, a farce and so on. But Olmert said, he said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close. He said that, you know, this is our last chance, that we have to come up with a valid two-state solution, or Israel as a Jewish state is finished. That's fascinating admission on his part. And he went on to say that if we don't come up with some kind of just two-state solution, the American people, upon whom, remember, because Israel depends upon the kindness of America and American Jews, and that is so central to bear in mind. The American people are not, he said, going to stand for the kind of injustice that we perpetrate, and that's quite an amazing remark. I don't think he knew what he was saying, really, but he said it, and it's worth studying. So I think that people have to start, first of all, taking something beyond the two-state solution, namely a democratic state, much more seriously. There are initiatives on the ground. I mean, there's the initiative from within Palestinian Israelis. That Israel should be a state of all of its citizens. And so these things are out there. It's current, and it needs to be reinforced. And the other thing, let me just say very briefly, is that, you know, we need to keep in mind that the Palestinian right of return is a valid principle according to the United Nations. It's valid according to international law, any concept of human rights, and it has to be pushed and promoted and developed in every way possible.
That's great. And if I can encapsulate our discussion by a phrase that you also wrote in your book. You said, if the curse of Zionism is to be lifted, the identity of Jews needs to be detached from the fortunes of the State of Israel.
Exactly.
And thank you so much, Professor Covell, for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure indeed to have you with us.
Likewise.
You have been listening to Dr. Joel Covell, Distinguished Professor of Social Studies at Bard College and author of Overcoming Zionism. Professor Covell will be giving a talk on his book this coming Tuesday, January 22nd, at the Coolidge Corner Theatre in Brookline, starting at 7 p.m. The talk will be followed by book signing and community discussion and a dinner at 9 p.m. at the Fugaku restaurant at 1280 Beacon Street. And now we pause for a moment to say, at this moment of great need, to the people of Palestine, we know about your immense suffering and we salute you. We admire your courage and the indomitable spirit you are showing every day in your struggle for freedom. As South African activist Stephen Biko said during South Africa's struggle against apartheid, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Let not your spirit falter for an instant, for it is your spirit that will ultimately carry the day. You are not alone. Your friends in the United States, and especially in Boston, stand in solidarity with you every step of the way. And that does it for today. This is Sherif Pham, signing off for This Week in Palestine.